Main menu. Hello and welcome to Main Menu, ACB Radio's look at technology from a blindness perspective. This week on Main Menu, Jamie Pauls brings us another Access Watch review. This one covers the Smart Computing Mainstream Technology magazine. After that, we hear from Matthew Horspool with three interviews from the July 17th, 18th, and 19th, 2007 Site Village Expo in the UK. First up is CareTech, followed by Dolphin Computer Access, and finally Solutions Radio. Finally, we have Aidan Stadden from the VI Tech Podcast, who will be talking with us all about file transfer protocol, FTP clients. All this is coming right up on ACB Radio Main Menu.
Welcome to a new series of Main Menu News Briefs, the segment of Main Menu that aims to give you a roundup of the latest in technology news. This week, Freedom Scientific released JAWS for Windows version 9.0 Public Beta 2 last Thursday. This build fixes several issues identified since the last public beta build posted last Monday. Customers who are authorized to use JAWS 8.0 can use this build like the last one with no restrictions, while those whose authorization does not cover JAWS 8.0 can still use the beta build in 40-minute demonstration mode. If you already have JAWS for Windows version 9.0 Public Beta 1 installed, you could use the Check for Updates feature in the JAWS Help menu to install the new update automatically. It's also available for download from the Freedom Scientific website at www.freedomscientific.com. Just to note that users of the beta build should expect bugs and report any they find to Freedom Scientific via the beta report form on the Freedom Scientific website. The Sendero Group have released a maps-only version of their popular BrailleNet GPS product, version 4 of which was released earlier this year. The as-yet-unnamed product has all of the features of the full BrailleNet GPS product, except the ability to use a GPS receiver. When released, it will be priced at $799, half the price of the full BrailleNet GPS software, but it can now be pre-ordered for $699, $100 off the final retail price. Until Wednesday, October the 31st, potential customers are invited to suggest a name for the product in an email to maps@senderogroup.com. The first person to submit the name chosen by Sendero Group will receive a copy of the product at no charge. Jamal Mazrui released version 2.3 of his Edge Sharp text editor on Monday. This version introduces a powerful scripting capability, strengthens HTML snippets, and adds support for mathematical work with the LATEX language. It can be obtained at www.empowermentzone.com/edsetup.exe. A link can also be found on Jeff Bishop's Desert Skies blog at www.tdspodcast.com. Nullsoft have released version 5.5 Beta 3 of their popular Winamp audio-video player, boasting a completely rewritten installer and ID3 tag editor, amongst other improvements. This beta version can be downloaded in three flavors, Pro, Full, and Light, and further information can be found in the Winamp discussion forum at forums.winamp.com. Yahoo and Microsoft have announced upgrades to their search engines in efforts to gain ground on rival Google. Google remains the most popular internet search engine, accounting for a 56% share of the US search market, compared to Yahoo with 23.3% and Microsoft with 11.3%. Its dominance has forced rivals to relaunch, add new features, and improve the reliance of its searches in an effort to compete. Microsoft improved Live Search, which will be available globally by the end of October, will offer a series of new features, including a quadrupling in its index of searchable web pages, as well as improving the way it delivers answers to specific questions. It will draw on its three-dimensional mapping service for location-relevant searches, as well as offering video, charts, and pictures relevant to results. Yahoo's upgrades include offering ways to phrase a search request as a user types into the query box. It will also use information from its calendar service, upcoming.org, to highlight local events when relevant to requests. Search rival Ask.com relaunched with a dramatically different interface in June, offering search suggestions and thumbnail pictures of listed sites. James Home is currently in the process of restoring the numerous programming resources to the Blind Programming website after a radical redesign which aims to make the site bigger and better than ever before. Resources include, but are not limited to, comprehensive manuals, tutorials, libraries, and examples of a variety of different programming languages, including Visual Basic, C++, and the JAWS for Windows scripting language. The site address is www.blindprogramming.com. A court in the US has ordered a woman to pay $222,000 in damages for illegally file-sharing music. The jury ordered Jamie Thomas, 32, from Minnesota, to pay for offering to share 24 specific songs online, a cost of $9,250 US per song. Ms. Thomas denied the charges, but record companies said she had illegally shared 1,702 songs. The U.S. record industry said investigators located an individual with the screen name Terriastar at Kazaa, using the Kazaa file-sharing software program. This individual was downloading copyrighted sound recordings from other users of the Kazaa network and was distributing copyrighted sound recordings stored on her own computer to other Kazaa users, the plaintiff said. Battle of the Blindness PDAs was the title of a presentation delivered by Brian Hartgen and Terry Clasper of TNT Consultancy Limited to the 2007 TechShare conference that took place last week in London, England. A recording is now available from their blog and podcast at tntconsultancy.wordpress.com. And finally this week, the September 2007 edition of TNT Consultancy Limited InfoTech magazine will contain a comprehensive review of the new Victor Reader Stream product from the Humanware Group, and will also continue a comparison of how the leading screen readers work with Microsoft Office 2007. A release date for the magazine has not yet been announced, but further information will be made available on its website at www.tnt-consultancy.com/infotech.html. And that's News Briefs for this week.
Hello Main Menu listeners, this is Jamie Pauls with another Access Watch review. Last time, I discussed Access World, a magazine produced especially for the visually impaired community. This week, I'd like to talk about Smart Computing. Smart Computing is a mainstream magazine, and it's available on cassette free of charge from NLS. But for $17 a month, you can also subscribe to the web version of the magazine. All articles are available for Smart Computing, as well as about four other magazines. You can also download a PDF version of the magazine, but it's not properly tagged, and I didn't find it particularly useful. I prefer the HTML format. Go to www.smartcomputing.com and check it out. Come visit us at www.accesswatch.info. And check out our blog at http://accesswatch.wordpress.com. Have a great week.
I'm here with a representative from a company called CareTech, which is based in Austria. There's Volker Litschel. I think I said that right?
Yes, you did.
And I'm just going to ask, what sort of products does CareTech sell? I haven't heard of CareTech before.
Well, CareTech has mainly products with speech output.
Right.
So we have talking devices and many different kind of talking devices. At the moment, we have nearly all the talking devices in up to 30 different kind of languages.
Oh, gosh,
so not only English and German and French and whatever. So what kind of products do we have? We have three different kind of scales. We've got a talking blood sugar meter, a talking blood pressure meter, which is the newest product that we have here on the exhibition.
Right.
We have a talking labeling system called the Sherlock. Then we have the Zeitgeist. Then we have two different kind of color detectors, the color test and the Colorino. We've got a talking tape measure. We've got, which is new too, we've got two different kind of talking battery chargers. And then we have some products which don't have any speech, but they have acoustic signals, or they vibrate. So we've got two different kind of battery testers and two different kind of light probes.
Oh gosh, so these are pretty extensive products. So some of them are designed for home use, and some of them are designed for sort of people in a job. So the sort of light probe could be used, for example, to see if the light's on. Is that right?
That is true.
And to see how light things are and how dark.
But not only that. Most of our products don't have one or two functions or features. They have more features. So the light probe has. You have the chance to find out if you want to sign a letter where the white part of the paper is.
Wow.
You can use it for to check if the light is on in your flat, or you can even see, you can hold it out of the window and see if the sun is out.
Goodness
and,
me.
And you can it has a third mode where you can really localize where the lamp comes, or where the light comes from and where the lamp is. And then you have another additional function where you can put on a small tip where you can check if the LED of a standby of a TV or whatsoever is on. So you have many different functions.
And several of your products, they're not original products, but there are several products that are. For example, I mean, the Zeitgeist, which is a talking time machine, is how I think I've heard this described in the past. A product with lots of features. Could you sort of describe those?
Oh, we just as we are located in nearly in the eastern part of Europe, actually,
right.
We had many inquiries of many neighbors wanted us to make a watch or a clock for them, and then we found out that we didn't want to make a simple watch and a clock which says the time and the date, but we wanted to collect all the features that you need or you can have related to time and put it into the Zeitgeist. So we've got two different kind of timers. You've got a stopwatch, you've got an hourly announcement which we call the cuckoo's clock, you have a wake-up call, you have got 10 different kind of alarms that you can set. It can be set daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, and then you can choose to each alarm, you can choose between 17 different kind of jingles. You can set the volume to the jingles, so it's something which you can adjust really as you like and as you need it.
So it's not just a talking watch or a talking clock.
No, it's a time machine, and that's why we call it a machine. Yes, and it's a lot of fun. So actually, it's not a time machine; it's a Tamagotchi. I'm not sure if you know what that is, but I know that our customers use it all the time because they just press it and find out what it says. Actually, we have, which might be strange in the UK, but we have a moon calendar inside, which tells you the status of the moon.
Yeah.
And additionally to that, it gives you propositions what you can do. So the place where I come.
So there are some fun functions in there as well.
Definitely,
not,
yes.
Yeah,
because
not just,
we always like to include something to give the customers a laugh.
Right. Okay. And the things even like the color detector. Now, everybody in the UK is familiar with Cobalt color detector, but your color detector has, it just seems to have many more features than the Cobalt one.
Well, it's a long time ago. We were the first company to come out with a color detector.
Right.
It's nearly 20 years ago.
Oh gosh, that's
so
a fair while ago.
The color test that we have now is the third or the fourth generation, not only in terms of how it looks like, but in terms of the hardware and the software, the techniques, and in terms of functionality. So the color test that we have now is similar like the Zeitgeist. It has so many different kind of functions added to it. We tend to say it's sort of like the Swiss knife for the blind.
Yeah.
And then eventually, some years ago, Cobalt came out with a cheaper device, and we said, well, why didn't we come up with the idea? And we came out with the Colorino, which is a limited version, does only up to 150 different kind of shades, which is still more than the device from the competitor.
Yeah.
But if you compare it to the color test can do up to 1,700 different kind of shades.
Gosh.
So the Colorino is limited, but it is cheaper, and people who are not acquainted with colors are very happy with the device too.
And what sort of features does the color test have that maybe the Colorino doesn't have?
Well, the Colorino just has the colors, but it has a built-in light probe too, so you have that. The color test has the time and the date. You can set a limited numbers of alarms. You
right.
have a you can play bingo with it. You have a roulette inside.
Yeah.
And you have a stopwatch and a timer. And the sophisticated model is the color test memo. Allows you to record things to it, so you can record to your alarms some vital information like don't forget to go to the doctor tomorrow, or
it's time for your doctor appointment now, even.
Or something like that. Mm. Yeah. So there's so many things that you can do with the color test.
And that probably brings me on to the final thing which I looked at and which I found particularly interesting, the Nano portable note taker.
Yes.
Is it a note taker? I mean, how would you describe that?
We would say it's a note taker. It has the input is Braille.
Right.
The output is speech. You have a Braille keyboard, and you have the four most important functions are you have agenda, you have address book, you have a calculator, even a scientific calculator.
Right.
And you can take notes, either you write notes or you can record notes.
And what sort of Braille does that support? I mean, is that just European Braille, or can you have other tables like the US Braille and the UK Braille?
Well, at the moment we have the UK Braille in the Nano. It is changeable, but it's not adjustable by the user.
Right.
But it is, yeah, it's something which might happen in the future. We're at the moment working on a new hardware for the device, and next year we will come out with a Nano with definitely more functions.
Okay. And presumably that Braille can be in grade 1 or grade 2?
At the moment it's just grade 1.
Yes. Oh, just grade 1.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a very interesting interview. And where can people find out more information about CareTech if they want to find out prices and such?
We have a few number of agents in the UK. If you have questions considering the Nano, then it's TechnoVision. If you have interest concerning the other products, it's either SW Retail or IC Online, as they are called too, or it's Hager Electronics.
Right, but have CareTech got a general website for the company themselves?
We have a website. It's www.caretech, which is CareTech.at. And we have all the CareTech products, and some others are in English too, so it is accessible for all our users.
For all Australians. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been fascinating.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I'm with a voice that's very familiar to many people in the blindness community. This is Dave Williams from Dolphin Computer Access. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Matthew. Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm very well.
Very good. And Dave, the previous director of ACB Radio. I'm also with Rachel from Dolphin Computer Access.
Well, hello.
I don't know if it's Dolphin Computer Access or whether it's a different
Dolphin,
branch of Dolphin.
Just
Dolphin.
Dolphin.
Just Dolphin. And she's with the Daisy products. So we'll start really just by glossing over what Dolphin does. And I mean, many people are familiar with the Dolphin software, HAL, Supernova, Luna, Luna Plus, just the general screen access and screen magnification software. So we'll concentrate more on the lesser known products, and we'll start with Dave because Dave's the mobile guy. So what does Dolphin do in the range of accessible PDAs, mobile phones, portability, etc.?
Okay, thanks Matthew. It's good to have the opportunity to speak to yourself and ACB Radio again. So on the mobile side of the house, we essentially have three products. We have the Dolphin Pen, which is a USB thumb drive allowing you to carry any of our access products with you as you go. So the products you already mentioned, Supernova, HAL, Luna, Luna Plus, you can have any of those on the Dolphin Pen on your USB thumb drive, which you carry with you, plug into a Windows machine, and it gives you your preferred mode of access, whether that be magnification, speech, Braille, or a combination of those. And of course your settings are restored from your previous session, so if you had a preferred verbosity scheme or colour settings in Luna or magnification level or particular Braille settings, then all of that is going to be restored when you plug your Dolphin Pen.
What about authorising the Dolphin Pen? Because Freedom Scientific released portable jaws that ran on a pen drive, and people are complaining about or having to authorised JAWS on the local computer that the authorisation isn't carried. What's the situation with the Dolphin Pen?
Well, I'm glad to say you don't have that problem with the Dolphin Pen, that the authorisation is tied to the pen itself. Each pen is unique, and the software that you receive is tied to that unique pen.
So presumably you have to buy the pen from Dolphin.
That's right, yes. Yeah, you don't... we send you the software already on the pen, so we don't send you the CD and tell you to go and buy yourself a USB thumb drive and then you set it all up yourself. You get the software on the pen, and it's one way to receive the software. We're going to have three options essentially in the future. You'll be able to get the software on CD, you'll be able to have the software as a download that you simply unlock, or you can get the software supplied to you on a USB thumb drive. So giving people that kind of choice and flexibility and independence. And if you do decide that you do need the pen, then you don't need to go through any kind of authorization. I don't think that the software is already there on the pen, tied to that particular pen. The two other products in the mobile group, I guess, are Pocket HAL and Smart HAL. Pocket HAL is a fully fledged screen reader for Windows mobile based PDAs, and the PDA, for those who don't know, they're quite widely used and are really designed for people who need to be productive on the move, so people who need to create documents when they're away from the office or away from the classroom. So Pocket HAL supports a range of Bluetooth keyboards and Braille displays, and is available in a range of languages supporting both grade 2 Braille input and output. So you've also got a choice of synthesizers there, the familiar Orpheus synthesizer that people have been used to with Dolphin products, that works extremely well at high speeds. That's available. Of course, the familiar Eloquence synthizer that people know from other products is available too, and I believe we also make available a cappella as well. So there's all sorts of options there, and as a fully fledged screen reader, it includes all the things that you would expect from an established screen reader, not only in terms of support for third party hardware, but we have a system for training non-standard PDA applications. That's our mapping system. We also have a system for creating verbosity schemes, which allow you to customise how any of the Windows controls are announced, and the list goes on. So really a full FAP a screen reader that you receive as a piece of software that you then install onto a mainstream PDA that you would purchase from a reputable PDA supplier.
Okay.
So or even a not so reputable PDA supplier. we don't really discriminate. The software still works.
So presumably this just runs on Windows CE or Windows Mobile.
Right. So Windows Mobile comes in. Basically speaking, Windows Mobile comes in two flavours. You've got Windows Mobile for Pocket PC PDAs. So essentially, those are the devices we're talking about right now. The PC. See in your pocket. Usually these devices have a touch screen. Some of them have QWERTY keyboards. Increasingly they have some kind of mobile phone built in, but an actual
it's not their main function.
No, exactly. The mobile phone's kind of like an add-on, really. So it's a bit like, you know, adding Skype to your computer. Oh, and Pocket Skype does work with Pocket HAL as well, I should say. So you can communicate, but really the emphasis is really on productivity, and that's why you have the mobile office applications there, Pocket Word, Pocket Excel, and Pocket PowerPoint. And so that's really what Pocket HAL does. And Pocket HAL, people should be aware of Pocket HAL. It's been around now for a little while. Now, the newest kid on the mobile block, as it were, is Smart Hal, and this is our screen reader for the other type of Windows mobile device, and that being the Windows Mobile smartphone. So these look and feel like regular cell phones. They've got a standard telephone keypad, most of them. Some of them have a QWERTY keypad, but most of them do not have a touch screen. They have just a regular screen. And these devices, the focus really is communication. So the emphasis here is, you know, if you want to dial a phone number, make a call, you can do that. And of course, Smart Hal is going to talk you through that. You've got a contact list there. All your contacts can be read, and your text messages, you can read and write text messages.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like the Symbian mobile phones that products like Talks use.
Absolutely right, Matthew. It basically is Talks for a smartphone. Basically, it's a very, very similar concept. It's a screen reader that will take you through and read all the features and functions that you find on the Windows Mobile. So it's making a new range of phones accessible using that familiar Eloquence or Orpheus speech synthesizer. And the best thing about Smart Hal that I really love telling people is that if you get Smart Hal and you decide to change from one Windows Mobile smartphone to another, that's okay.
No upgrade price.
That's okay. There's no cross-grade price. There's no cross-grade price. Obviously, if we put new features in, then may be an upgrade.
Price.
But yeah, there's no cross-grade fee. So the software is licensed to you, Matthew, not to the device, the particularly, phone. Per se. Yeah. Mm.
Just to go back, you were talking about Orpheus, and there are several flavours of Orpheus. I think there are two flavours of Orpheus. There's the synthetic Orpheus, which we're all familiar with, and there's also a fairly new... Well, I say fairly, I don't know actually how long it's been around, the concatenated Orpheus. Which license of Orpheus, which version of Orpheus do you ship on these mobile products?
So on the smartphone, it's just a synthetic Orpheus, because we tend to find that the smartphones run a little bit slower, they've got a little bit less memory,
right.
And so we want a synthesizer that's going to perform well under those conditions, and that's also why we've chosen to use Eloquence there as well.
Because it's just so responsive.
Because, exactly right, it's low memory footprint, there's not too much of a load on the processor. So that's really why Orpheus and Eloquence are suitable for use on the smartphone. Now, on the Pocket PC, those devices tend to be a little bit faster, they have more memory, so we're able to make available the concatenated Orpheus voice.
Which one's which? Which one's the announcer product and which one's the pronouncer product?
Now you've got me, Matthew.
I know that you usually get
both with the when you get the concatenated, that doesn't preclude the synthetic. That's there as well.
Right.
So with Orpheus, I think it's important that people are aware that Dolphin don't develop Orpheus directly anymore. We have decided to focus on our access and alt format and mobile tools, and we have become a little bit more synthesizer agnostic, I guess you could describe it as.
You tend to use other synthesizers as opposed to just saying our synthesizer the best, go with that sort of thing.
So Orpheus is available, certainly, and in some languages Orpheus is the only option available, and so right. We've already identified that it works very well at high speeds and very intelligible and actually very clear on the phone. It's almost as though it was made for the phone, because it really sounds crisp and clear on the Windows Mobile smartphone. And there are languages that we will only be able to offer with Orpheus, because I'm not aware of any of the other synthesizers doing Welsh, for example, and I think Orpheus does that. So there's 25 languages in Orpheus, which is pretty impressive, I think.
Okay, we're now going to move on to the second person I've got with me. This is Rachel from Dolphin. She's in charge of the Daisy software, and Dolphin Daisy software has been around for a few years, actually. The first time I was introduced to Dolphin Daisy software, there was Easy Reader and Easy Publisher, but now the range has expanded a bit. So if you could just describe what the range is and what each product does.
Yes, certainly, Matthew. First of all, just to put Daisy into context, Daisy is an alternative format that's used by people with visual impairments, but also learners with, or people generally with dyslexia, basic skills needs, perhaps English as a second language, or different preferred learning styles. So people who prefer to listen to as well as perhaps view on their screen their text. So the key thing about DAISY is that it's navigable. Navigable talking books. Sometimes people refer to it as DAISY formatting or DAISY books. Other people will refer to it as DTBs, digital talking books. So different names that people use. The key thing, as I say, is that you can navigate through a book with DAISY.
Navigation is huge, isn't it? It's absolutely huge. If you've got a fully compliant DAISY book with text and audio, navigation is just a snap in the book.
This is it. It takes away so much frustration, and it's also very motivational as well. And it saves time, which has got to be good. So you mentioned, Matthew, several products that we've had in the range for a few years now. Publisher is our professional authoring tool. So this tends to be for organisations who are established DAISY producers. It will create DAISY books, but as well as using synthetic voices, you can actually add in human voice as well, add in pop-up pictures, and do a lot of quite extensive formatting with it. What we also have, and we've had in the range now for a couple of years, is a product called Easy Producer. A very nice, simple to use tool to create DAISY books. The key criteria with this one, Matthew, is that your source document needs to start in Word.
Right.
You're literally within Word formatting, just writing in, putting in your navigation points.
So how does one go about doing that in Word? Is it just regular formatting?
Just regular Word formatting, so just highlighting the area that needs to be seen as a navigation point, be it a title or a subheading, and literally making it either a main heading or a sub-heading. Really easy, nice and easy to do. So literally, Easy Producer, click of a button, you create a DAISY book.
And how does that work with regard to text and audio? Does it give you text? Does it give you audio?
It synchronises.
How synchronised is it?
Your text and audio. With your DAISY books, you might decide that all that you want is the audio version.
Right.
The audio files within your DAISY book are in MP3 format. So you can just extract the MP3 files and listen to them either on a DAISY hardware player or on, for example, Windows Media on your computer, or even have them on your MP3 player, take it away and listen to it when you're on the move. And this is where DAISY is becoming a very popular format. It's opening it up to such a wide range of people.
What reads the audio with Easy Producer?
The synthesizer that we have with Producer, it comes with a choice of either ScanSoft Daniel as the default or ScanSoft Emily.
I take it both of these are British voices, one male and one female.
Yes, they are. In fact, when people hear Daniel for the first time, people always say to me, "Oh, Rachel, he sounds like a sort of BBC news reader."
Mm.
It's a very nice, easy to listen to voice. And I must say, Matthew, when I go and visit colleges and universities, it does tend to be the first question people ask, what's the synthesizer like?
I don't want to be listening to a robot when I go to work in the morning.
Absolutely, and they do breathe a bit of a sigh of relief when they hear it and they say yes. But people who aren't used to listening to synthesized voices, if we're using the DAISY books with a wider audience than just our visually impaired learners, for example, our dyslexic learners, English as a second language, basic skills learners, it's a really nice introduction and an easy voice to listen to.
Right.
So that's Easy Producer. I know that you're keen to find out about our newest product, which is called Easy Converter. An Easy Converter is a tool that we launched just 2 months ago. And it's literally a one-stop shop for organisations, be they commercial organisations recognising their responsibilities under disability equality duty, whether they be schools, colleges, local councils, libraries.
This is not just a DAISY product. This converts
literally a sort of one-stop shop, Matthew, for organisations that have a range of clients, customers, learners, and therefore they're going to have a range of needs in the way of alternative formats.
Mm.
So, whereas with Easy Producer, we create a DAISY book with the MP3 element from an initial Word document, with Easy Converter, your source document could be Word or text or HTML or PDF. The program contains a powerful optical character recognition piece of software, and it will put it in an intermediary stage of being in a Word document.
Mm.
So therefore, you can do any sort of tweaking and editing in that Word document.
And fix any OCR errors that come up.
Absolutely.
Some of which can be very amusing, actually.
What sort of documents? At that point, you can always save it as a project and think, right, well, we don't actually need anybody needing these alternative formats at this point in time, but we'll save it for future reference.
Mm.
So it's lovely. You can build up a whole library of resources, especially documents that you might use year in, year out, but just need to change the date on them or a person's name on them. And then as and when you decide to, you can then output to a range of alternative formats. Text, which a lot of people like just as a storage system.
Plain text, that's a .txt extension.
Indeed.
So very, very portable, very, very small.
Absolutely. Large print. And again, this is the one that when I see people, they say, this saves so much time with the Easy Converter, from having to adjust all of the indents and the page breaks and pictures that don't fit to page.
So how does that work? I mean, does that just sort of automate that task in Microsoft Word, or has it got its own engine?
Right, what we have is a settings button, and again, what we've made to be the case in Easy Converter is that it's very intuitive, and again, that's the feedback that I'm getting, Matthew. Because what we wanted was a product that would be easy to use, so that in organisations people wouldn't marginalise it and say, oh, that's somebody else's responsibility, but everybody could take it on board and be responsible for creating alternative formats.
So presumably it just takes the input Word document, sets it up according to the settings that you specify, and then outputs it to a second Word document.
Outputs it, exactly. So as we say, we've got text, large print, Braille, DAISY formatting, as we previously discussed, and just through to the MP3 audio as well.
Again, so using ScanSoft Daniel and ScanSoft Emily?
Indeed. But again, you can add in there any other SAPI 5 synthesizers that you've already got on your system. So it's such a quick, effective tool, Matthew. The feedback that I'm getting from people is that they're saying it's saving a lot of time from sending things out to transcription centres, where sometimes a turnaround can be up to 2 weeks. So the company's left waiting, and more importantly, the end user's left waiting. So it cuts out that time delay. Therefore, cuts out that huge expense of sending documents externally. And also for organisations that do their production in-house, they often have specialists in different areas of large print or Braille. So this is where it's pulled all together into one piece of software. So it saves resources in time spent in-house in an organisation as well. So often allowing teachers, for example, to spend more time face-to-face with the learner than having to go away and prepare documents.
What about Braille? Is there any plans to include Braille and make a Braille translator out of this?
Yes, currently in version 1, the system will link into any Brailing software that you have, so it will prepare the document to link into, example, Duxbury
or
WinBraille.
Yes. Do you still sell Cypher?
Right, we do. We're currently updating our own software for Braille translations, and that will be in the next version, so that will be coming shortly for any organisations that don't have.
Which means that you just have one piece of software that produces your large print,
indeed,
your Braille, your audio. Yeah. And of course that'd be useful for the end user as well, not necessarily just organisations. If an end user's got a PDF document that they've downloaded, I don't know, off the government's website, the latest government leaflet.
Yes, again, certainly attachments are often in PDF format such as that, as you say, Matthew. So often in colleges and universities, public libraries, they're looking at putting it on a public access computer. So
that anybody use it.
Anybody can access it. So really super tool, we're very proud to show that.
All this sounds very exciting. Either of you can answer this one really, where can one find out more information if they want?
That's really straightforward. It's all the W's dot yourdolphin.com is the dolphin website. Yourdolphin, YourDolphin.com.
Is there any person that they can contact if they want to speak to someone in person or via email rather than going onto a website?
Yeah, you can email info@dolphinuk.co.uk for people living in the UK, or I think in the US it's info@dolphinusa.com. And our sales teams are ready and waiting to take your inquiries. If people need support, if you've got a demo of a Dolphin product and you have a technical question, you just want more technical information than you're able to find on the website, you're looking for something you can't find, then of course you can write to our support teams. So in the UK, that's support@
DolphinUK.co.uk.
That's right, yeah. And in the US, it's support@DolphinUSA.com. But I should also say that many of Dolphin's products are available through other companies around the world. And so I would urge people to go to the website, because we do have a list of all our dealers on there and information about our dealers, and then you can link through to our dealers' website, and that will mean that you'll get local support in the area that you are. So that's an important channel of communication with Dolphin, is through the dealers.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's much appreciated.
Thank you, Matthew.
And that's all right, Matthew. It's been a pleasure, and appreciate you coming by.
Thank you. I'm now talking to a representative from, I think it's a relatively new company, I certainly haven't heard of them before. They're called Solutions Radio. Just out of interest, I mean, how long's the company been around? Because I've never actually heard of them before.
We've been around since November 2003, when we were an original private company in the Netherlands.
Right, so you're based up in the Netherlands, because I've never actually heard of you before. And what products are you marketing at SiteVillage this year?
We're marketing specifically the Orion Web Box, which is an acronym for online reading and information on demand.
Right. So what does it do?
Well, it's a device that connects to the internet, but the beauty of it is that you do not need a computer to operate it. And it gives you access to talking books, talking newspapers, talking magazines, podcasts, internet radio, anything and everything that's available on the internet.
Right, so it's audio. So what file formats does it play? Presumably MP3.
And Windows Media.
And Windows Media, and then it can interpret DAISY files as well?
It can read DAISY books.
Right. Okay, so let's just describe the box that I've got in front.
It's a dark grey box. It's about the size of two big books. It has a big internal loudspeaker.
Very, very big. It's very, very nice and loud.
It is, but if you still don't like the quality, you do have connectors on the back to connect to your hi-fi installation.
Right, and I should mention that these are actually proper stereo. You've got a left and a right, I think.
Correct.
I think it's RCA, I think, although
That's
I'm not
right.
sure. So it's not just a 3.5-inch jack.
No. And you can also connect your headphones to it.
Oh, so how would one go about plugging headphones
in? You get a cable from us which connects onto this, and you can connect onto your headphones.
Ah, right. So it's
a separate cable set.
It's an
add-on.
Right. Okay. And then on the back, and obviously there's a power cord, Ethernet port.
Yes.
There's even a couple of modem jacks.
That's right. That's ideal for the United States, because local calls are flat rate, so United States doesn't need to get an internet connection. They can just use their plain telephone system.
Right.
However, it has a disadvantage because the quality is only telephone quality.
Right, yeah, obviously. And then on the front then, or on the top, should I say, there's a few buttons.
There's a display.
There's a display first on the extreme left, yeah.
Yes. Then there are two cursor buttons, then below that is an OK button,
and
a back button, and then an on-off button.
Yep.
The largest of all is the volume button.
Okay, so if I turn this on...
It would normally do a few
Welcome to the Orion Webbox main menu. Press the OK button when you hear the option you want. You can choose from the following. 1. Announcements. 2. My bookmarked items. 3. Internet radio. 4. Talking books.
Okay, so if I press OK on talking books.
You have chosen 4. Talking books. You can choose from the following. Be My Enemy by Christopher Brookmeyer. Clara by Janice Galloway. In Another Light by Andrew Gregg.
Press enter on that one.
Okay.
This book is produced by RNIB.
And it just starts to play the book. So if I press the volume button in the middle, that'll mute it. Now, does that just mute it or does it pause it?
It pauses it.
And then I can press it again to resume it.
Continue. Okay.
So this is a very, very easy to use device. I presume I could have used the arrow keys to move through the menu if I wanted to.
Yes, I could even show you if we just go back. We just switch it on and I'm just going to go back.
You have chosen 4.
Go back one more.
Welcome to the Orion Red Box main menu. Press the OK button when you hear the option you want.
Now just hear how fast
that
goes.
You can choose from the following. 8, 7, 6, 5, magazines and newspapers. 4, 3, 2.
So you can scroll through.
Yes.
But for those that don't want to scroll through, then they can just
choose from the following.
Wait until it says the right option.
Yes. I'm just going to switch it off. You wait for the item to pass by. If you are too late, you can switch the unit off and ask them in and repeat the whole menu. So for an elderly person, it's easy to operate.
Very easy to operate, yeah. And do you have any idea of the price, either in UK pounds or euros or dollars or anything?
Yes, in the UK it would be the price of a good Daisy player, which is around about £300.
So it's £300, and what do you get for that? I presume you get the box itself.
You get the box itself, and you get some free content on it, such as internet radio stations. But after that, its value would be that you would have to.
Go online,
but you would have to tell RNIB, for example, that you are interested in their books and magazines, or you go to talking newspapers and tell them that you are legally blind and have a right to listen to the information, and they connect you. It has a unique serial number, and it would recognize you. Because when you switch the unit off and you've switched it on again, it goes to a server and it says, this is serial number XYZ belonging to... I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Belonging to Matthew.
Okay, yep. Matthew, belonging to Matthew. Matthew, you have the right to get RNIB's talking books and you have the right to get TNF's talking newspapers.
Right.
Because you paid for it or because you've told them that you want to listen to it, and then automatically you will get that content.
So it's very, very automatic. There's no complex technical process involved in sort of setting it up or anything.
No.
Okay.
The device itself is quite simple. The intelligence is on the server side.
Right.
And it depends on the content provider or the person organizing or managing the system, how complicated they want to make it, how much information they want to give to the outside world, how much they want to do.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this up in a bit, but just before I do, the internet radio site, how does one go about programming these in? I mean, do you program them in, or is there a way for me, let's say there's a new internet radio starting, is there a way for me to program that in?
There is. There are two versions of this, and we've had a lot of queries about those who only want to use it as an internet radio station.
Right.
The device would be cheaper, because you would need the program guide. You would get a password from us, access our server, and we have a database of 5,500 radio stations at the moment. You make your choice, you pick and you cut and paste, and if you have your own URL or your own radio station, maybe you've got one, you're a freelancer by any chance, you could add that URL and you've made your personal playlist.
Right, so I could add stations. But would that require a computer, or could you still do that from the device?
That would require the computer. That's why we're not advertising that version on this exhibition.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And make it clear, this would be a completely separate product.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating interview. If someone wants more information, where can they find? I mean, have you got a website or something?
Yes, we do. It's www.solutionsradio.com. solutionsradio.com.
Solutionsradio.com. And who sells this product in, I presume RNIB sell it in the UK?
Not yet. We're still in the trial phase, and we haven't found a distributor in the UK yet. But we're doing well in Holland, and we're doing well in the United States.
Oh, who sells it in the United States? That might be pretty popular.
Actually, a couple of reading services have found us on of their own accord, and we've sold to them, and they've sold to their listeners, and I believe that's Alaska and Oregon.
Okay, so is there a list of those dealers on the website?
Excuse me, a list of
them? Is there a list of the distributors on the Solutions Radio website?
No, we don't really have a distributor. A colleague of mine goes around in the States and tries to do business on his own.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating interview, and good luck with the product.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
Hi, I'm Aidan Staden, trying out my hosting abilities on Vitech. Today we're going to be talking about FTP, or File Transfer Protocol, servers and clients. And of course with me is Brandon and Matthew, our stand-ins, old experienced computer users, to lend their opinions. So, FTP, as I said, stands for File Transfer Protocol, and it's one of the it's the easiest way, rather than just a link to a file, to actually access files on the network. For those of you who don't know, when you load an FTP server up on your computer, when you browse an FTP server with whatever you use, you basically see a list of files or folders. You find the file or folder you want, you tell it to download, it downloads, it's on your computer. You don't have to go through a whole bunch of links and web pages and logins and things like that. Now there's two ways of accessing FTP servers. The first and probably the easiest way for the complete novice is a web browser, including a program such as Internet Explorer, which comes on all Windows PCs, or Mozilla Firefox, which is more open source, which people can download. The advantage of the web browser is it's easy. For example, if I'll use my FTP address, for example, you go into the web browser, you go to the open box, you type in ftp://guest:guest@aidan.myftp.org:5900. And that will, without any fuss, get you to browse my guest folder. Now the disadvantages to web browsers is, or the main disadvantage to web browser, and anyone else can stop me if they have any other opinions as well, is that when you start downloading from the FTP server, say you're downloading a very large file, it will not resume. If there's a problem with your computer or a problem with the server, it will time out and you'll have to start downloading over again.
As well, I've noticed using Firefox, especially both Internet Explorer and Firefox, but Firefox's messages are incredibly annoying. Randomly, for no apparent reason, it will throw up FTP error messages, you know, like folder unavailable or path not found. And if you were to use a client, an FTP client, like even the built-in Windows Explorer view, it works. But for some reason, if you're using Internet Explorer 7 or Firefox, it'll throw up an error message sometimes as well. If you're downloading a file, it doesn't... It can stop randomly, but sometimes it can actually think it's complete. So there's no way for you to resume, even if the browser you're using supports resuming. I don't really know why this is. I guess web browsers don't support FTP as well as the FTP clients do.
Well, no, because the web browser, of course, was designed for just that. It was designed for the web, for HTTP, and FTP was just a nice thing that they put in as a sort of additional thing. It's not its primary purpose.
You think, though, Firefox would be a little bit more, you know, just because
possibly, but it's a web browser, not an FTP and
yeah, but they didn't make it their top priority.
True.
Also, it's probably to do with the speed of servers as well. I mean, I know my server in particular is slowed to a crawl many, many times. In fact, if anybody who listens to this does try to use my server, I would seriously recommend using an FTP client. In fact, I'm going to make that my welcome message on my server. Best to download a client for my server and use that, because it will actually work reliably. That's another thing I should say about web browsers, is when they, in Internet Explorer 7, they decided, before Internet Explorer 7, you could use, when you opened an FTP site in Internet Explorer, you were presented with a list view just like Windows Explorer, just like as if you clicked on my document on the desktop. It was the same kind of list. Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom in Internet Explorer 7, decided to make it into a web page. So now, instead of a list, just a straight list, you have links, previous directory, all the folders and files, which may have some advantages, but for some people, it could be more confusing.
Microsoft
I've also seen that. I've seen that pop up in IE6 sometimes. I don't know.
Really?
Where. I saw it pop up at school, and they use IE6, and.
Oh.
No, there is a way around it. There's an option in the view menu, which I think it's in the view menu anyway, and I think it's view site in Windows Explorer. So the list option is still there.
Yeah.
I guess you can.
Yeah, Microsoft didn't really have the idea. They just stole it from Firefox, because Firefox had already been using the...
I didn't mean they had the idea. I just meant they used it.
Yeah.
As I said, in their infinite wisdom, yeah. Well, great for some
Firefox
people.
Is doing it, so it must be cool.
Yeah, no kidding. Just look at the latest My Fave scandal.
Yeah.
T-Mobile has 5 faves. Rogers copied T-Mobile blatantly and TELUS tried to make it their own. How pathetic is that?
Well, let's not go into that. I can tell you why they did that later.
Yeah, and
so,
Explorer, it's in the view menu called Open Site in Windows Explorer, and that pops into the lists.
Yeah.
Okay, and that will turn the current web page into an Internet Explorer list. What?
Yeah. And you can upload using that list, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas you can't upload using that page.
Just
if you have a home page,
right.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's the other
thing
about the list.
The list is... It's like an Explorer window in every sense of the word. You can, if you have the correct privileges, of course, you can use Control-C and Control-V and possibly even Control-X, although I'm not sure, to move files
if you have the delete privileges.
You can do it. You can do it from an FTP site to your computer or from your computer to your FTP site, and it pops up a nice little box that tells you how many minutes are remaining, even though it's sometimes not the most accurate you can get. It's still a rough idea.
Yeah. It turns your FTP folder into a hard drive. And then I suppose that just leads into another client that we've kind of forgotten about, is the network drive tool in Windows Explorer. If you go to map network drive, doesn't that allow you to map an FTP server as a hard drive?
Yes.
Yeah, so that would allow that too. You can map any FTP server basically as another hard drive, which would be a way of also browsing. But again, you have the same disadvantages that you do in Internet Explorer or a web browser, because it's using Windows Explorer. So if one thing on either end messes up, bye bye 10 gig file.
Yeah.
It can be quite annoying. So overall, if you can hack it, use an FTP client, because you get a lot of... And there are some pretty ones to use, but we'll go over them in a minute. But they would be... It is the easiest way to transfer files to and from an FTP server if you're on your own computer. So for FTP clients, we've all used similar clients. And I think one thing we should talk about is the first one that I think almost everybody has used is file. Well, I guess we should first talk. I guess we should first talk about while we're on the subject of web browsers, download managers. The program that a lot of people use for downloading files is called, so generically, Free Download Manager, and the website is, you guessed it, freedownloadmanager.org. Matthew, I believe you have had experience and you can get it to browse FTP sites. I was never able to get it working, but I guess it is possible.
I can. Now, I need to test very quickly if you can log into an FTP site after you've connected to it. Something tells me that you can't. But anyway, if I want to view an FTP site in FTM, I press Alt-3 from the main FTM window, which takes me into an edit combo box. This actually works for web pages as well, which is kind of cool. And I then type in ftp:// username:password@site.extensions. So I might, with Aiden's example, guest:guest@aiden.myftp.org:5900, right? And it would connect to the server, it would log in, and it's very similar to what Explorer does. It will pop up a list of all the files, and I can press the application key on the file, and there's a variety of things I can do. I can, if it's a folder, I can open the folder. I can open the parent folder to it, if there is a parent folder. I can disconnect the site. I can download, and I can tell it to download a whole folder if I want. I can right click on a folder and choose download.
Now I've I've never used FDM as an FTP client. How is it? Like compared to FileZilla even. Like how?
I think it's kept FTP simple.
Okay. That's good, because...
The simplest of commands, because sometimes, we'll talk more in a bit, but sometimes I've used FileZilla on servers, and it's refused to work.
Yes.
But I've used FTM to download files, and it's worked wonderfully. So I think it keeps FTP simple. But, it works.
And will it resume? Do you know? Does it support resuming?
Yes, it does.
FTM reports resuming on HTTP.
And FTM is now open source for your information.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah, they open sourced that, didn't they?
Yeah, isn't that good? That's exciting a little bit.
And of course, just a reminder, open source means that the source code is now available to modify. So if, for example, somebody wanted to add a speech module to FTM to make it self-voicing, they could do that.
Yeah, but just a quickie, don't try downloading the FTM source code unless you can read it, because I made that mistake once. I thought, hey, I can do anything I want with this program. So I downloaded the source code and looked at it and thought, actually, what does all this mean?
Yeah.
So,
I shouldn't say anyone. I should say anyone who knows what they're doing. It's very important.
It's not fun to learn code by looking at something like a download manager or something like that, because it's so complex.
It really is.
Now, another thing I should go into is talk about Matthew briefly mentioned commands, FTP commands. Especially back in the old days when we didn't have all these cool lists and things that we do with Windows now, back in the, as I call them, the good old days of DOS, because everything was text and really easy to read from a screen reader, you entered commands into the FTP server. And if you're going to some FTP clients, like, for example, FileZilla, you can actually see all the commands. The servers still operate with commands. The lists are just a more friendly way to show the files to users. So if you go into something like, for example, FileZilla, which we'll get into, and you look at the log, there's a log box, it will actually show you all the commands. So if you want, you could actually use, and you have one of those old systems, you can actually get in and use, you can manually, if you'd like to, use commands to do whatever you want. Download files.
Actually, you could do that in later versions of Windows as well. The DOS console FTP program is still there.
That's useful.
You go into the run dialog, and now, how does this work? Let me just try. If I go into run dialog, and well... Actually, I think you can do it directly. I think you can just type in FTP aiden.myftp.org.
Well, that'll open IE. That'll open Internet Explorer. I've done that
before. No, because you do FTP space.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
FTP space aiden.myftp.org. And what's the port again?
5900.
:5900. Let me try that.
I think it's space 5900, because it's the same as the Telnet protocol.
Well, we can say for the record of the podcast that it is possible to somehow, even though we're not quite sure yet how, to enter FTP mode from a DOS window in later versions of Windows, and to download files using commands if you know all the commands and if you like DOS better, which, frankly, I wouldn't blame anybody because DOS actually works. So now that we've dealt with Windows' new and old ways of handling FTP servers, we should probably, and the non-conventional FTP clients, we should get into the conventional FTP clients, and that is, I suppose we should all start with the old favorite, FileZilla. Now, I've personally used FileZilla. It's another open source program. Yay!
Yay!
I've used FileZilla. It's actually, it can be obtained from sourceforge.net, which is an open source site.
FileZilla.sourceforge.net.
It's FileZilla, yes, .sourceforge. And I've found FileZilla to work. I wouldn't recommend it for a complete novice, but FileZilla certainly has some good features. I believe it can be run from USB, can't it?
Yes. There's a portable version at portableapps.com, I think.
Yeah, there's a portable version of that. When you first load the program, you get an edit box for the address. You enter the FT... It's called the Quick Connect bar. When you first load the program, you get the Quick Connect bar, where it just says address. You enter the address. Tab. I believe it's username, port,
then password, then
username,
then
and password.
Port.
Okay, that one. And
in the newer FileZilla, it's host, user, pass, and port.
Okay, yeah, I think
and
it's
that's
the same
all it asks.
Yeah, it's
and then
all
quick
asks
connect.
The version I used here.
Once you hit enter on the quick connect button, you can tab and you get this to the log box, or as Jaws calls it, read-only edit, and that will tell you all the commands and responses from the servers. So, you know, when it tells you when it logs into the server. And then gives a directory listing. It says list, and the service responds directory listing successful. And then the next tab over brings you to a local site edit combo, which is basically like your address bar for Windows Explorer. FileZilla has its own version, though. You have to use this version. This will allow you to point to either where you want to download files to on the FTP server or upload. You then have a tree view and a list view where you can navigate different folders. Then you have the remote site edit combo, which is like the address bar for the FTP server, and then you have a list view, which is your directory of where you are on the FTP server.
And in later versions of FileZilla, you also have a tree view as well.
Oh, for the server. Oh, that's nice. Then now the dot,
well,
dot...
It can be quite difficult to use with JAWS because every time you browse to a directory that FileZilla hasn't seen before in the tree view, it has to then go and get the list and populate the tree view with items, so JAWS can sometimes get a little bit confused on that tree view for the remote site.
So
the local site, it's fine, but the remote site, it can be a bit difficult.
Because it actually has to download. So I guess it's best when you browse to a directory to wait a few seconds and maybe push insert escape to refresh the screen to...
Well, you don't need to do insert escape or anything. I'm just saying that don't arrow up and down too quickly in the tree view.
Okay.
For the remote sites, because it can get confused.
If I were to use FileZilla, I would probably stick to be cautious and just use the list view, but that's just me, because...
Actually, I tend to use the edit combo. The edit combo is really useful on some FTP sites, particularly if you're on a... Let's say you're on an FTP site for a server. Let's say you're a server administrator. Now, this isn't a website, this is a web server. And let's say you have, it's called root access, basically means access to the entire hard drive. And let's say that you're hosting a website which is about 5 directories deep. Having the address bar can be really useful because you can just type, I don't know, /home/horsepool/domains/thehorsepools.com/public-html, and it will get you to the website directory without having to browse through that list.
Oh, that's always good.
So it means that you can avoid downloading loads and loads of directory listings that you don't need.
Right.
And also, you can root backwards and forwards. So let's say I'm in that directory and I want to move to somebody else's web directory. rather than going back and forth, I can just type /home/Aiden/domain/blah blah blah, and it will get me there. I wouldn't have to go back up and then back down.
And if you're going to a hidden directory,
it works better because it's been The one thing about hidden files in Windows people should know is that when files are hidden, just because they're hidden doesn't mean they're not accessible. If people know the name of the actual file, they can type it into an address bar and it will actually get them to that file.
Yeah,
so,
same with NEOS, actually.
They're just not visible.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, okay, well, yeah, I guess that would make the address bar rather useful. Just so people know, the .dot folder at the top of the list is actually a back button to the previous folder. Unless, of course, you're in the top folder, and then it does nothing if it doesn't crash the server.
One of the problems...
Sometimes if you've got a really, really poorly configured server, or even sometimes an intentionally misconfigured server, the server might put you into a weird address. Like, let's say you are going into a website. The server might put you into the directory for the website by default. But you can still use the dot dot to go up into higher level directories so for example to browse your email folders.
That's helpful. So, and then
it doesn't work on servers, but it does work on some.
That's good to know. Yeah, the FileZilla seems to have a lot of those features, which is nice. To download a file or upload a file. To upload, for example, you would use a local site browser to point to the file, push the application's key, and go to upload. It will then
The remote site is at the right place as well.
Yes, I was just going to say, it would then upload to the current directory on the remote site that is currently displayed in the list. To download, it's the same thing. You point the local site browser at where you want to download to. You then find the file on the FTP server, you push the application's key, and push download. It will then download it. Now, if you tab from the local or remote site after that list box, you will find another list box, and that is your queue. That is all the files that are set up to be downloaded. Now, I personally haven't got this. Yes, that is your transfer queue. That is all the files set to be transferred. Now, I personally have not got this to work with JAWS very well at all. If I play around with the JAWS cursor, I can get an idea of what's downloading and how much time remaining in one or two files.
I've got this to work flawlessly.
Okay.
For me, but bear in mind, I think, Aiden, what version of FileZilla are you using?
2.2 something.
Right, you see, I'm using FileZilla 3, so in FileZilla 2 is a little bit different to FileZilla 3 in how the main user interface works, but in FileZilla 3, the queue works wonderfully. It basically shows the FTP site at the top of the list. And then underneath that, it shows the path and file name of the remote file, I can't remember if it's the remote file and then the local file, or the local file then the remote file, but it shows both.
In 2.2, it was the local and the remote.
Yeah, I think it might be the same in 3. It shows both of those, and then it shows the status of it next to it, so it might show failed, transferring, waiting, or whatever. And then if that current file is downloading or is transferring, there will then be another line underneath that file, another list view item underneath that, which will show the time elapsed, the time remaining, and the download speed. Which is really useful. So I might be able to. I might not be able to see what file is downloading exactly because it truncates the path if it's too long. But underneath that, I will at least be able to see the file it's downloading.
And the time. So, do you have any thoughts on FileZilla, Brandon? Or?
Has FileZilla 3 improved on focus issues? Because I remember in 2.2, if you all tabbed out of it and went back, it was kind of a pain to get back into the main.
Yeah, people need to be aware of that. If you alt tab out of FileZilla and alt tab back, and you haven't tabbed through the window, so let's say you've just started up FileZilla, this doesn't tend to happen with the Quick Connect bar active. But if you deactivate the Quick Connect bar, What can sometimes happen is FileZilla can very easily lose focus. So what you need to do to fix that is, as soon as you start FileZilla, tab once and then maximize the window, and then it shouldn't lose focus like that.
Okay, that's good to know, because that's one of the reasons I wasn't really so keen on FileZilla. But there you go.
The main window can lose focus. And it's a pain. When I say lose focus, it loses focus, and focus won't return to it either. So to close it, you have to use... I've been using the task manager to close it. But that's what I've had to do. I've had to go into the task manager and close it that way.
That's like pulling its plug pretty brutally.
Yeah.
Now, this is in 3 as well, right?
I don't know if it's in 3. I haven't tried it in 3.
We've all been using FileZilla 2.2 until just recently when 3 came out, and Matthew's our expert on 3. Or I should call him, as they call them at Microsoft, or SME, Subject Matter Expert, or SME. FileZilla 3. So that's I figured I could use that term for Microsoft. So, and our next client, I suppose, after FileZilla, that we've all used is FTP Voyager. Now, I believe that also has a USB portable app. And that is a little bit easier to use for the novice. Well, now that I know about Free Download Manager,
Now, I don't entirely agree with you on the usability factor, Aiden. When I tried FTP Voyager, I found it really cumbersome to use.
Can I just go back to something before you carry on? Aiden said that Free Download Manager is the easiest thing to use, and I'll just say that yes, it is, but only for downloading. You cannot upload files using FDM because it's a download manager.
Okay. Yeah. I actually just said that now that I know about Free Download Manager, I was thinking about changing my opinion with Voyager, but yeah, it would just be for downloading. Yeah.
When I used.
Well, I guess most novices don't really download anyway, but yeah. I was just thinking. Very, very newbie. The new newbie.
Yeah. You know, I found it to be very cumbersome, especially if you wanted to add sites to a site, to the site manager in that program. I mean, FileZilla has its drawbacks, but it's easy to use and it's straightforward once you get into it. The site manager basically is a way of organizing all the FTP sites you connect to. You basically add sites to it, you know, you give it a name, and you enter all the information, you know, your username and password, and it stores it for you. It makes things really easy when you're trying to connect to a bunch of FTP sites, and you can't memorize all your logins and all that kind of stuff, so that's
the format for the site manager in FileZilla is kind of like the quick connect bar. It's got a few more fields, and once you've entered them, you just hit enter on the last. Yeah, this is important. This is what I didn't do the first time. When you add an FTP site in the FileZilla site manager, when you enter on the last field, which is your password, you push enter. That will then save the site, and it will connect to your FTP site.
Yeah.
It will then, to access the site manager in FileZilla again, well, for any time, you push Control S when you start it. And it will then open up and display a list of all your FTP sites.
Mm-hmm.
FileZilla and all the good FTP clients have them. The traditional FTP clients.
Yeah.
So they're a nice way to just add. If you're, say, setting up somebody with an FTP server, I know I've been thinking of setting up my aunt, who is rather computer illiterate, with a way to download books from me so I can give her some books. I thought that maybe FileZilla might work.
Yeah, because it's straightforward enough, right?
Yeah, it's straightforward, and you can just do that. FTP Voyager would work too.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about podcasts as well. Basically, just setting up a single podcast feed so she can subscribe to it.
You could set up
the book.
Yeah, well, I'll talk to you about that later.
But the FTP servers would, if I did that, I would set up my site in the site manager and tell her, okay, when you start this program, you press Control S, press down to get to my site, or just click on the word Aiden, and it will then connect you to my site right away.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have just saved all the fuss for her. But if you're setting it up yourself and you don't necessarily know what you're doing, It's straightforward.
Yeah.
And it does make things a lot easier to memorize. You don't have to memorize logins.
Back to FTP Voyager, though. The advantages to FTP Voyager, in my opinion, are the once you're on a FTP site, it's one tab to each site. So your site is one list view, and the FTP server is another list view, and that's it. That's what it has over FileZilla. Because FileZilla has more list views, and you know there's a little bit more tabbing around.
The quick connect bar can kind of confuse you a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that the queue in FTP Voyager might look a little bit better. Although,
yeah,
like I said,
I
haven't used it.
I love the queue in FTP Voyager. It's Windows, right? When you download something, it shows up in like a download window.
Yes, you can. Yeah, you also close it, I believe.
But. Yeah. So it's nice. It's
one thing that isn't so good about FTP Voyager is if you're using a screen reader such as JAWS and you start the program, you have to wait for about 15 seconds and there will be no sound. And if you try to move the JAWS too much or get impatient, it will crash. We thought it was because of the splash screen. We're not sure. But I turned off the splash screen, but still did it. The splash screen is basically a pretty little banner that comes up, probably displaying FTP Voyager written by whoever for a few seconds, and then it goes to the normal site. But even with that turned off, JAWS still froze for a good few seconds, and if I was impatient, it would crash FTP Voyager, or if the computer wasn't feeling too happy, the whole computer. So I usually learn to just push enter on FTP Voyager, wait a good few seconds, and then the normal screen will come up with, I believe it has a quick connect bar too, or you can go to the profile manager with F11. But that is one thing about FTP Voyager that's good as well, is the F keys actually do things. So I believe it's F9 will disconnect. I think it's F10 will reconnect. I'm not sure. F11 will open the profile manager, which is the same as the site manager. It's just profile is a different word. So one thing I haven't
tried. Yeah, now talking about connections, does FTP Voyager allow you to connect to multiple sites? Because I think, I don't think FileZilla does, but I'm sure it's possible on some clients.
You probably can't browse multiple sites. But you should be able to.
Could you say download from one site and connect to another site? And upload to that at the same time without running a second instance of Voyager.
I haven't tried it. I haven't gotten too far into that much, but I don't see what.
No, because I seem to remember that was there in Voyager, but I honestly can't remember where it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a good thing if that's possible. So, do you have any other thoughts, Brendan?
FTP Voyager is made by a company called Renosoft. They also make a server called Serview. I'm pretty sure FTP Voyager is $49, but I can't tell from the website because it's not on the buy page. It's just the quantity doesn't tell you till you actually want to pay for it, and I'm not going through the process. So there you go.
Yeah, and just to say one of the really really nice features about Voyager now. Voyager was the first real FTP client that I used. And I didn't use it for very long. I must say. But one of the really nice features that I liked was the site synchronize feature. I could press a hotkey on a site, and it would download the entire contents of that site, or it would download any files which were either updated on the server or which I didn't have. And then I think if you had the right privileges, it would also upload any files that I had that the server didn't have. And it's just a really nice feature. If, for example, like I do, I work on ACB Radio Interactive, and they have a promos library. And if I've been away from the computer for a month or so, and I want to know what new promos they've got, rather than reading through every single email to try and find the one email from ACB Radio that says there's a new promo, if I had FTP Voyager, I could just press a keystroke on the ACB Radio site, and it would download all the new promos, but it would only download the new promos. It wouldn't download the old promos.
Yeah, that would be helpful. That's good. That's good that Voyager has that feature. That's, I can see that being very useful. And now I suppose that those are the main two clients, unless anyone else knows of any other clients they want to plug.
I've used FlashFXP for, I think it was only a trial version, but I didn't use it for very long. Yeah. I really didn't like it.
Me neither.
I really didn't like it.
It's so popular in the sighted world, but I don't really like it.
Well, don't forget.
I found there were loads of bugs in it where every so often it would forget your download directory and all sorts. And having said that, it was kind of cool because you could transfer with one keystroke, but you couldn't really use the queue very easily, and it wasn't a very nice client, so I don't recommend FlashFXP.
So now that we've plugged all our FTP clients, plugged away at FTP clients, I guess it's now time to move on to servers. These are the programs that actually host FTP sites, so these are the programs that I took, installed on my computer, hooked up my 500 gigabyte hard drive as a sharing directory with all my material in it, and I'm now sharing to the public or any members of the public which have my address, which I gave earlier, the guest address. I guess we should first start with the FileZilla FTP server, because they made the FileZilla server, the same as the FileZilla client, made by the same people. I did try the FileZilla server a few times, but I was using a router and I had to use a different port to access the FTP server, and I was not able to get that FileZilla set up through my router. So after some passionate tinkering, Mobin and I decided that Guild FTP would work better, and we were right. It did work for me. But Matthew, I believe you got FileZilla server to work.
Yeah, I got it working now. First of all, just to describe...
Comes into play here.
Just to describe briefly how it works, because it's a strange thing. First of all, you have the server daemon, which is the server itself. This is the thing that actually does all the serving. Then you have the server administrator. This is a separate client. And it's the server administrator that where you go to update the configuration and add users and add groups of users, which we'll briefly touch on. So the server daemon, all you do is click on it, and it says, do you really want to start the server? And you click yes, and the server's started up. By default, it uses port number 21. So if you want to host an FTP server, and I'm going to get technical because people need to know this information if you're going to be a server host. If you want to host an FTP server on the standard port, you need to make sure that port number 21 is forwarded through your router from the internal IP address of the server to your external IP address.
We should probably actually have mentioned before as well that if you log into any server, the default port is port 21. So if your client insists that you enter a port and you don't know the port for the server, enter 21.
I've never seen a client where you have to enter a port.
Zilla, if the port is entry and if the port is empty in FileZilla client, it assumes 21.
Same with FTP.
Okay. I don't know. I'm just thinking if there are any clients where you do have to enter the port, then yes, 21 is the... And if you see it enter 21, it's because 21 is the default port in most servers, unless, like mine, use a different port. Most servers...
Yeah, some ISPs block port 21 because they don't really want consumers running FTP servers and, quote, wasting their bandwidth. So if you want to run an FTP server in that kind of environment, you'll have to run it on a different port. And just like if you were running on port 21, you're going to have to make sure said port is forwarded on your router.
In my case, 5900.
Yeah, you can get instructions for forwarding ports at portforward.com.
Can you really?
And you need to make sure that they are sent, the appropriate ports are forwarded from the internal IP address of the server to your external IP address. For those that aren't interested in hosting a server, obviously you can just ignore all this information.
Yeah.
But then for those who are interested, you can ignore this whole part of the podcast as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this would allow the... what I would do is I would go into my router, I would select whichever IP address my computer is, or I would, in some routers, you can just select the computer name, and then you would just, from the network, and then say, forward port 5900 private, 5900 public, hit forward, and it then forwards that port. Now, a really good site to test your ports as well, Brendan mentioned port4.com will give you instructions. The website canyouseeme.org is a port check tool. So what I've had to do many, many times, is every time I mess up or have to reinstall the server, is go to canyouseeme.org, enter port 5900 into the box. It knows my IP address already. So then it will then check port 5900 and say, yes, I can see your service on port 5900. So that's a very good website to know if you are planning on hosting a server and you need to play around with ports.
Going back to the FileZilla, you started the FileZilla server daemon. The next thing is to start the FileZilla server interface. This, by default, runs on port 14147. I think it's 14147 anyway. This port does not have to be forwarded. In fact, I recommend that if you're only going to be making changes to the server on the machine that it's running on, don't forward this port through, because it's got the potential to allow hackers in and to hack your server very, very easily. So, no, don't forward that port through, unless you have to, of course.
Or you want to be hacked.
Well, no, not necessarily.
Or
you
want to access the server remotely.
Yeah, exactly, if you want to administer the server remotely from another machine.
You can disable remote administration somewhere in FileZilla server.
I think you can, but if you don't forward the port, then there's no chance of it being enabled, is there?
I suppose that's another thing we should have mentioned in clients, is the FTP commands. Not only will they let you download from the server, but if you have administrative access, they will actually let you remote control the server through FTP commands. I believe you can delete files and do things like that. So that is another way of accessing and managing things remotely. But that's the beauty of these double program systems, like FileZilla server. You've got the server daemon and the actual interface. Is if I went over to a friend in Vancouver and someone says, you know, and say I left a file to download over the weekend while I was at my house, I could then add that file to the server remotely from Brandon's with the FileZilla server interface program.
Yeah.
If I had the port forwarded. But no, it's not a good idea unless you know exactly what you're doing to avoid hostile hackers taking over your server.
But the admin thing is really, really, really cool once you learn how to use it. Until you've learned how to use it, this whole thing can be a bit confusing. And I'm not going to go through all the options because there are far too many of them. But just be advised that it can be confusing. I recommend that you sit at this server administrator on a day when you've got nothing else to do, when you've got a really clear mind, and sit there and think about what you're doing really, really carefully. Otherwise, you are going to get confused.
Yeah,
I can promise you that. The most confusing thing in the is adding users. In fact, I might just briefly explain that process. You've basically got groups and users. Now, groups are useful because I could set up a group, and I could call it Vitex staff, for example, and I could set this group up so that the folders that are accessible to the group might be Vitech raw logs, Vitech staff meetings, Vitech website code, etc. And those folders will be shared with the group. And I could also set, for example, I only want to have 3 users on this group, even though there could be 5 users to the server at any one time. I only want to allow 3 users on the Vitech group at the same time. And I could say block these IP addresses or only allow these IP addresses to log in to a user account that's with that group, and I can set speed limits and all sorts. And then I can create a user account. I can create a user account for myself, for Mabeen, for Aiden, for Brandon, blah, blah, blah. And I could add them to the Vitek group, which means that if they log in with their username, they immediately have all of the restrictions that have been placed by the Vitek group. I don't have to manually add all the folders for each user. But it does mean that if I want to, for example, give Mo access to the Vitek production elements and a few other things like that, I can do that. I can give Mo access to Vitek Productions, Vitek Gmail login account information, blah, 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 by adding those files just to the user accounts. This is where groups and users can be really useful. And this is where it starts to get really, really confusing, because you have to set up the directory, and then you have to set up directory aliases. And I'm not going to sit here and talk about directory aliases, because they're the most confusing things until you've got used to them, and I don't really know how best to explain them. But suffice it to say that they are quite difficult until you've got used to them. Once you've got used to them, they're really easy to do, and you can do them really quickly. But until you have,
are just neat. Yeah, they're just names for directories, aren't they? For example,
They're names for the directory, but how do you set them relative? Yeah. So, for example,
oh God,
I might have a directory called Vitek, and I might want to share this Vitek directory with everybody.
But you could call it home Vitek to the server.
Right, exactly. But the path to the Vitek directory might be /my/files/Vitek. Now I've got the Vitek administrator folder, which has got all the elements in it and everything, and all the login info and stuff. And the address for that might, just for argument's sake, be /my/private/files/the/Vitek administrator. So if I share the Vitek folder with the group, I have to set the Vitek folder as what's called the home folder on the FTP site. So when people log into the FTP server, they see the contents of the Vitek folder. They don't have to click on Vitek to see the contents of the Vitek folder. They just see it straight away. But then I need to set the server to put a folder, or to put a shortcut inside that folder for Mo's account to redirect Mo to the Vitek administrator account, which, as you just heard, is in a completely Vitek administrator folder, which is in a completely separate location to Vitek. And this is where directory aliases can be a pain, because I'd need to set up a shortcut in the server from that directory to the other directory, and it can be really confusing. Once you've got it going, it really works, and it works well.
Have you used Guild?
No.
Have you used Guild at all? Okay. Yeah, we both can.
Yeah.
So FileZilla, as we said, the server daemon option, which is what FileZilla and ServU and a few other servers use, does have some advantages, because you can access it remotely from the interface, but then it has some disadvantages as well, being a little bit more confusing. The next type of server that I'm using now, which is why I was able to explain directory aliases, I had the concept of directory aliases grasped pretty quickly, is the one, I guess I would call it the one program device, which is just, for example, Guild FTP is one of those. That's what I switched to, and that's what I use now.
Same with me.
Now, Guild FTP streamlines a lot of the options for you. When I used Guild, for one thing, it worked very quickly. I was able to forward my port without any fuss. CanYouSeeMe.org did see me. Adding users is simple. Now with JAWS, it's a little bit difficult. You have to use the JAWS cursor. You have to find the menu bar, go down to the to where it says system, then root PC to JAWS to bring up your view of all your options that are outside the menu bar. Then you go down to default, then you go into, and you see all these users. All the users that you've created. I believe Guild uses groups as well.
Yes.
So Guild can use groups, but I haven't really gotten into that. I just use the users. And I just, what I do is once it says default opened, remember you've gone down from system to default, just push the applications key, you can go to add group or add user, you add the user, you set their home directory is set by default, but you can set that. So you can change the home directory, and this is where directory aliases are made easy, because you just go to add directory, and you can browse, just like File Explorer, Windows Explorer, you can browse to any directory you want, you press OK, and the next path is virtual path, and that is what do they see on the server. So for example, if I had my guest directory, my home directory, which I had for the guest account, on the server, the virtual path for my downloads directory is /data, which would mean that if you were to use the address bar, as we talked about before, to log into my server and you got into the guest, you would just type in /data/books, and you would get into my books directory. I could change, if I wanted to change that, I could change that name to Aiden's Files, or Aiden's Dirty Great Hard Drive. And so they would type in /Aiden's Dirty Great Hard Drive/books. If I were to be that conceited. It's just data. So that has kind of streamlined a lot of the options.
Yeah.
I found Go to be pretty good ever since, well, my roommate likes to blame Guild for slowing down our internet, but
no.
It turned Guild off, and it's actually spyware. Guild will not slow down the internet very much. I just like the way you can adjust things on the fly,
mm-hmm.
and restarting the server to basically accept all your changes is just one keystroke, Alt-R.
Yep.
As long as you don't have any users on there, that's fine. I've currently given my FTP address out to a lot of people, and I always feel a twinge of regret every time I shut down my computer or have to restart it, because I know that some of the people are using Internet Explorer. I do tell them, I have told them many times, use an FTP client.
Stubborn.
It's easier.
It's easier.
I am going to set my welcome message at some point when I know the setting will be saved to say, I would recommend you actually use an FTP client because the server can go down from time to time and you don't want to be left in the lurch.
No.
Let me just
interrupt you a second. You've been talking about the welcome message. Let me just, for those that are not familiar with the welcome message, in fact, I don't think Internet Explorer displays the welcome message.
I think it does in the web view. I'm not sure.
In the web view, but it doesn't do it in the list view.
No.
If you go to help,
but
you can display it.
Basically, the welcome message is the first thing the FTP server sends. So when a client connects to it, the FTP server might send, for example, welcome to Matthew's server. This server is running on a LAN connection. It may be down from time to time. Please have a good time and don't download too much. And it might just display something like that. Some servers will display things like, this server has been up for 3 days, received 52 megabytes, and sent 194 megabytes.
Mm-hmm. I like to put...
There are all sorts of things that can be put in the welcome message,
yeah.
But the welcome message is just the first thing that it sends, introducing you to what the server is.
I like to put something funny in my welcome message. So if you ever get my address and you see my welcome message, it's hilarious.
Different welcome messages can display different things, but it's basically agreeing that the server sends. Now, in that log that we mentioned before in the files or in the client, you will actually see the welcome message of the server. I believe my welcome message now is something so generic. Welcome to Guild FTP produced by blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, I'm going to change that as soon as the setting will be saved. But, yes, if you want to look at... It might be actually useful to look at welcome messages for servers that you log into, because they can contain useful information,
yeah.
Websites and such. So if you can add access to that log, I would recommend that you actually, when you connect to a server, that you read
it. Another message that could be useful now, in some servers you can configure this message, and in some servers you can't. In FileZilla you can't. But the other one is when you log in, the server can sometimes send you another message. In most servers, this is just you are successfully logged in or welcome or something like that. But on some servers, you can configure this. So you could say, if Mabin logs in, I could configure his welcome message to say something like, hi Mo, welcome back. I've put 3 new files in this directory for you, for example.
Can you do that?
As I said, in some servers, I don't know if you can do it in Guild. In Faza, you can't, but in some servers you can, so it may be worth looking out for that as well. Immediately after the login.
That's cool. You can set messages for, like, when a download completes and stuff, so I've set up funny things for that as well. Yeah, it's really fun, because, you know, you can really...
Except it's too bad that most clients don't seem to display them as actual windows.
Most clients, you can see them in the log, but that's it. But still, I mean, if you know that you're sending, if you're putting a message in for someone, then, I mean, you can tell them and they can look for it.
Or some clients should at least display the message. You should be able to pop up a box and display the message.
Some clients do. I think FTP Voyager does, but I'm not sure. But Guild FTP is free, just like FileZilla. It's not open source, I don't think. But it's free. There's a forum and all that stuff if you need support. Support's a lot easier to get with Guild FTP on their website than it is with FileZilla.
So I'd say Guild has been my program of choice. So that's basically all with clients and servers.
Another thing that might be worth very, very briefly touching on is something that I haven't used in a while, but a server called SlimFTPD.
Never heard of
this
it.
This is it. No. It's a nice server, and I can't remember the website address. I think it's something like www.witsoftdev.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's a nice server because it's free and it's small, so I can download. I think it's about 100 or 200k. It's tiny. It really is. There's no fancy install process at all. You just unzip a zip file to whatever directory you want. And everything's edited, everything's set, configured in a configuration file. So this allows you to remotely configure your server directly from an FTP client. If you have the appropriate directory, you can download your slimftpd.conf file, modify it, and re-upload it. And I think you have to kill the server and restart it for the changes to take effect. But it's a really, really simple server to configure. Because you just open a text file. The text file has lots of help in there, so it shows you what to do. And you just type, for example, max user is 8, port 21, blah, blah, blah. And then you set up a user, and it's really simple. You say username equals blah, blah, blah. Password equals blah, blah, blah. Then you type something like /d:/FTP, which sets d:/FTP as the home directory. And then underneath that, you put the permissions for that directory. So it's just a really, really simple way of configuring a server. If you want to put a server up in a hurry, then I think SlimFTPD is useful. It's not very powerful, but it's useful if you want to put something up in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Well, I hope that you enjoyed my hosting debut, and I hope this will there'll be many more of these, unless I hear too many caustic remarks about how horrible a host I was. Everybody have a good week.
Hayden Stadden bringing to a close today's issue of Vitech. If you'd like to get in contact with us about anything you've heard on today's program or the Vitech podcast and website in general, you can do so in three ways. You can email us privately at vitechpodcast@gmail.com. That's vitechpodcast@gmail.com. You can give us a ring if you live in the United Kingdom. Just pick up the phone and dial 0700-598-1840. That's 0700-598-1840. Or if you would like to interact with other Vitech listeners and Vitech panelists, Vitech staff members, then join the Vitech Podcast Google group using any email address you like, by sending a blank email message to vitechpodcast-subscribe@googlegroups.com. That's vitechpodcast-subscribe@googlegroups.com. But from me, from Aiden, the Vitech panel, and everybody else involved in this enterprise, goodbye.
and thank you very much for listening.
This concludes another week of Main Menu. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to contact us, please send an email to mainmenu@acbradio.org. That's mainmenu@acbradio.org. If you'd like to subscribe to our mailing list, please send a message to main-menu-subscribe@googlegroups.com. That's main-menu-subscribe@googlegroups.com. googlegroups.com. Feel free to stay tuned to our blog. That's at mainmenu.acbradio.org. We will see you next week for another episode of Main Menu.